From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump and House Speaker Paul Ryan are still trying to line up enough votes to pass the Republican health care plan ahead of tonight's vote. To win over conservatives, Republicans are considering repealing mandatory coverage of essential health benefits such as maternity care and emergency services. Joining us now is Pennsylvania Congressman Lou Barletta, a Republican who swung yesterday from a no vote to a yes after a promise that people in the U.S. illegally would not be able to qualify for tax credits to offset the cost of insurance. And Congressman, that swung you to yes, but aren't you worried that 24 million people, according to the Congressional Budget Office, will lose their health insurance because of this bill?
Well, most Americans would agree that illegal immigrants shouldn't be getting tax credits. There were so many Americans, 20 million Americans, who said they didn't want any part of the Affordable Care Act anymore. However, at the same time, I think it's reasonable for anyone to consider that we should be verifying a Social Security number before we give a tax credit.
But are you worried about all the people that are supposedly going to lose health insurance under this plan?
Well, I'm not so certain. I don't think anyone's certain how many people are going to lose health insurance under the plan. Are we concerned with how many people got an insurance card under Obamacare and couldn't use it? And then add the millions of people who were able to use their health care prior to Obamacare and no longer could afford their deductibles or the premiums. So I think it's unfair to just look at one segment of the population and believe that Obamacare actually helped all of those people, because I had many people in my district who were under Obamacare who told me it didn't do them any good anyway because they couldn't afford the out-of-pocket cost to go to the doctor.
Well, let me ask you about another issue that's come up. Now, you're not a member of the Freedom Caucus, but they apparently won a promise last night that would repeal the requirement in Obamacare that insurance must cover essential benefits such as outpatient care, emergency services, pregnancy, maternity and newborn care, mental health and substance abuse treatment, lab tests. Would you be okay with that if they removed that requirement for insurers?
Well, and again, this is a moving target right now as we speak. There are negotiations going on that some members want in. There are other parts of the bill that will maybe changed or come out. So I don't think there's any member who, at this point, until we see what the final version of this bill is, could really come to a conclusion on whether or not you're going to support what that final bill looks like. You know, that might be something that, you know, I object to, but there may be other things that are happening as we speak again that will change the bill. So we have to wait to see what the final version of this bill will look like, because it may be much different than what it looked like when I said that I would vote yes.
So are you saying that you do object to removing the list of essential health benefits?
I'm saying I have concerns with that. I have concerns with that certainly. But again, we're going to wait to see what the final bill looks like and whether or not it's something that I could live with. Listen, we can't leave the American people under Obamacare. So whatever we end up doing will be better for the American people than what they have as a whole. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't move from good to great by making changes, again, to things that aren't working, that maybe can work better. To get this exactly right, where everyone is satisfied in the country, is next to impossible.
But are you worried about the idea of this being rushed through? Because if you're saying changes are still being made and people are talking about a vote tonight, isn't that just what Republicans complained about with Democrats doing with the Affordable Care Act?
Jeremy, I don't think you can compare what the Democrats did with Obamacare to what we've been done. Nancy Pelosi herself, I'm sure you remember this quote, "We had to pass it to see what was in it." You know, we've been talking for weeks now about what's in our bill, so I think that's pretty unfair.
So do you think it'll pass?
It's hard to say. I can't give you an opinion on that until I see what the final bill will look like. You know, we're looking at it very closely and tearing it apart. But I do believe we need to get people out from under Obamacare, which is going to crash on its own. It's not going to exist if we do nothing. So, there may be parts of this that some people don't like, but that, doesn't mean that we can't make it better.
One more question, Congressman. Senator John McCain has called for a special committee to review the Trump campaign's connections to Russia because he says the House Intelligence Committee has lost credibility after its chairman, Devin Nunes, went to the White House yesterday to brief the president before members of his own committee about evidence of surveillance. Do you agree with that?
I'd have to look at it closer. I mean, I have some concerns being a member of the president's transition team. I'm troubled by the news itself of what may have gone on. So I'm going to look at that very closely.
That's Lou Barletta, Republican congressman from Pennsylvania. Congressman, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
Well, in an interview today with Time magazine, President Trump defended his claims of being surveilled by pointing to Devin Nunes' claims yesterday. But this morning, Nunes came out of a meeting with his co-chair, the Democrat Adam Schiff, and the Intelligence Committee, saying he couldn't show anyone the evidence he'd seen and seeming chastened.
There was a lot going on yesterday, and it was a judgment call on my part. And that's, at the end of the day, that's... sometimes you make the right decision, sometimes you make the wrong one, but you got to stick by the decisions you make.
So where are we? Matthew Waxman is a national security law professor at Columbia University. He also served in the George W. Bush administration. So Matthew, yesterday Nunes said President Trump aides may have been swept up incidentally during legal monitoring, not regarding the Russian investigation. Your interpretation?
What this seems to mean is that the U.S. government was engaged in legal surveillance of other people, probably, for example, foreign government officials, which of course it does in the course of regular and legal intelligence collection, and that in the course of that surveillance, if those valid foreign intelligence targets spoke on the phone with Trump campaign or transition officials, then that communication would have been picked up.
But Nunes said his real concern was that some Trump associates were unmasked. In other words, they were either named or you could figure out who they were. What does that mean to you?
It could mean that they are a part of an investigation, but it could mean also merely that it was important in understanding the context of the intelligence to know who was on the other end of the line. So sometimes the identities of Americans are unmasked in the course of regular foreign intelligence.
How common is it for a lawmaker in an investigative committee to go directly to the president, who could be a target of maybe three investigations in Washington right now, a Senate, a House, and an FBI, and give him information that he hasn't given to his own committee?
Well, that's a very serious breach of protocol. We're talking about an intelligence oversight chairman who is supposed to be independent of the executive branch. This is a committee that is supposed to be conducting its own politically impartial oversight of intelligence agencies. So why would he be coordinating, especially by himself, with the White House? That's troubling, and it certainly gives at least the appearance that his neutrality is very compromised. It creates doubt that Congress can perform impartial and rigorous oversight, including its own investigation into Russian meddling in our election. And I think it's also likely to contribute to the very culture of leaking that Chairman Nunes says he cares so much about.
Well, speaking of leaks, Representative Castro, a Democrat on the committee, came out of the meeting with Nunes this morning. First of all, said Nunes apologized to them for not telling them first. But then Castro made a point he's made before that he believes that people who are leaking, and Nunes is now leaking, may actually have what Castro's calling political Munchausen by proxy syndrome. This is a reference to the illness where parents make their children sick because they're the only ones who can help them. Terrible. Castro's saying this is politicians making a mess only they're capable of cleaning up. But your sense of these leaks, will they make it impossible for intelligence people to come to these committees?
I think it probably does. I think it may have a couple of unintended consequences. One is it may actually inhibit communication between the intelligence agencies and the congressional oversight committees. And it may also contribute to what I think is a problematic culture of leaking, especially when it comes to surveillance issues. If the chairman of the committee committee is comfortable going out several times in the course of a single day and making claims about what was and wasn't picked up in the course of surveillance, it may be sending a signal that it's okay to be talking about these kinds of things.
Well, Senator McCain over on the Senate side says he has never seen anything like it. Who would this go to? If it's taken away from the House committee, who does it go to?
Well, I think this may provide actually further support for the idea of needing to create a special select committee.
Of congresspeople? Or?
Probably lawmakers. A special prosecutor is problematic. I think probably the best option is to create something like a special select committee of lawmakers.
That's Matthew Waxman, National Security Law Professor at Columbia University. Professor Matthew, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
The man who's been called the Donald Trump of the Philippines was elected president last year on a promise of reducing crime. Rodrigo Duterte has delivered on that promise in a bloody way. And now a bill to restore the death penalty in the Philippines has passed the House of Representatives, which is also considering a bill to lower the age of criminal responsibility to 9 years old. Michael Sullivan reports from Manila.
House Speaker Pantaleon Alvarez has no problem with locking up second graders who are breaking bad.
When you prosecute a 9 years old, you inculcate into their minds their responsibility to the society.
Tough love for tough times, President Duterte's point man in the House reckons, in a society where he says drug dealers have already co-opted too many kids.
These kids are being used by the drug lords to sell the illegal drugs. They know pretty well that minors aged 15 and below are not criminally responsible.
So make them, he says, and crime of all types will drop. Alvarez rejects the idea that 9-year-olds aren't necessarily capable of discerning right from wrong. Kids today, he says, are way smarter than they used to be. Quicker.
Quicker, and with the access in, internet, children now are more learned compared to children when I studied law.
Senator Francis Pangilinan isn't buying any of it.
It's a cop-out. It's bullying, minors, children, second grade.
And it's frustrating for Pangilinan, too, who just a decade ago helped pass the law that got the age raised from 9 to 15.
Why not go after the criminal syndicates? Why go after the child? Children in the second grade shouldn't go through criminal prosecution. They should be given a second chance and be rehabilitated through a process of diversion or rehabilitation.
Here at Bahay Pagasa, a juvenile rehabilitation center in Metro Manila's Valenzuela City, they're doing just that.
Presently, we are catering to a total of 72 clients, and their crimes committed were basically property-related crimes like theft and robbery.
Maria Lourdes Gardose is a social worker here. Hyvie Romano is the psychometrician for these clients.
The psychometrician do some psychological tests to determine their cognitive and emotional quotient.
And in that capacity, he sees a lot of youthful offenders and has an almost 9-year-old boy of his own at home. So I ask him, is the Speaker of the House right when he says today's 9-year-olds are old enough to be put into the system?
No, definitely no. I think that is too young to be prosecuted. That is too young to be incarcerated.
Is that you as a father speaking or you as a psychometrician?
As a professional psychometrician.
And as a father?
As a father also.
Critics of the bill worry that lowering the age of criminal responsibility will strain an already overtaxed system where some juveniles still end up in jail with adult offenders. Speaker Alvarez says that won't happen and promises funding more centers like this one to ensure it doesn't. But his support for the bill, complete.
We have to address the rising commission of crime, especially the heinous crimes in this country.
Opponents like Senator Pangilinan say that assertion doesn't add up about crime in general and that committed by juveniles, according to the government's own numbers.
Because less than 2% of crimes are committed by children. It does not make sense. It is not based on the data. It's not based on the information and the facts.
And neither is the war on drugs, he insists. But in the current political climate, he says, none of that seems to matter.
For if you have an administration or a president who likes to present himself as an anti-crime tough guy, then it fits in.
For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Manila.
Well, since January, about 3,800 New Jersey parents have opted to lay their infants down to sleep in simple cardboard boxes. Parents in San Francisco and New Hampshire are doing it, too. It's not a furniture trend. It's not about saving money. It's an initiative pediatricians say could save lives and reduce the incidence of sudden infant death, which killed about 3,700 babies in the U.S. in 2015. And by the way, the U.S. is behind 25 other countries in infant mortality, including Finland, which has been distributing baby boxes for the last 70 years and has the lowest infant mortality rate in the world. Dr. Catherine McCanns is the chair of the New Jersey Child Fatality and Near Fatality Review Board. They're pairing with the Baby Box Company to launch that state's initiative. We'll post a picture of the baby box at hereandnow.org. But Dr. McCanns, they look like cardboard boxes. Is that all it is, a cardboard box?
They are a cardboard box with a well-fitted mattress that's very firm and a simple well-fitted crib sheet.
Okay, so talk about the whys. Why is this safer than a crib?
It is not safer than a crib that is meeting all the recommendations for safe sleep. This program is really meant to decrease what we call SUID deaths, which is sudden unexpected infant deaths. Those deaths are comprised of SIDS plus a number of causes of sleep-related death that are impacted by the environment the baby's in. So these deaths can include accidental overlying when the baby's sharing a surface with another person, suffocation when they get trapped under blankets or in pillows, strangulation if something wraps around the baby's neck, entrapment when the baby gets stuck between a poorly fitted mattress or cushion and some other surface that's part of their sleep environment.
Well, so when you have a crib, you could have it perfectly safe if you have a perfectly fitting mattress and if you have a perfectly tight sheet, blankets and other things that people love to put in for their babies. It sounds like it's just the spareness of the box that's its benefit.
That's true. So what we are trying to promote is a safe sleep environment and parents making adhering to all the recommendations that decrease the risk for SIDS and SUIDs. And we, you know, make our cribs look beautiful for our babies because we think that's going to, you know, be a benefit to them. But the reality is you don't want any pillows, bumpers, blankets, stuffed animals in the crib with them. You don't need any additional layers underneath the crib sheet, between the crib sheet and the mattress. All of those can contribute to unsafe sleep. But we can make other choices like providing a tobacco-free environment prenatally and postnatally. That is a big contributor to decreased SIDS risk. Ensuring that mothers have prenatal care, that mothers breastfeed exclusively for the first 6 months, but any breastfeeding is protective against SIDS in particular. And so there's a list of recommendations that has been put out by the American Academy of Pediatrics Task Force that talks about all the things we can do. We recommend that infants sleep in the room with the parent, but not on the same surface. So falling asleep on a couch with an infant is a particular hazard. It is higher risk than falling asleep in a bed with a baby. And this effort to decrease SIDS and infant and sleep-related deaths really started with the Back to Sleep campaign in the 1990s. And that dramatically decreased the incidence of SIDS. People don't make the choice because sometimes they don't know, or frequently they don't know all of this information.
Right. I mean, the advertising is geared toward how many things can you buy people when they have a baby to stuff inside the crib. So now this simple spare box, again, it's about the simplicity of the box. Tell us more about the education. How should babies sleep? Backs, side? You know, what else do you learn when you start using the box?
Well, a baby needs to go to sleep on their back every time. It's a particular risk for a baby if they are mostly put to sleep on their back and then an alternative caretaker puts them to sleep on their belly. That actually increases a baby's risk. But for our program in New Jersey, it's about, in order to get your box for free, you need to do the education. And it's inexpensive. So there should be no barrier for someone obtaining this. And we anticipate as many as 105,000 baby boxes to be given out in New Jersey this year based on predicted birth rate. It's the cost of the box that allows us to do the program. One of the nice things about the box is that it's portable. You know, it makes it an ability to take the box and put it next to the parent's bed or bring it down to the living surface and prevent a child being put to sleep on their, say, on a sofa or something like that. You could take it with you to the family barbecue or when you travel. I mean, that's, to me, one of the assets of the box. You can find lots of things on the market that people are selling that, frankly, have been proven to be unsafe. So these positioners for babies, they aren't safe. Babies need to sleep on their back. So using a positioner device to keep them on their side is not recommended. Baby monitors do not increase babies' safety from a sleep perspective.
Look, the stats coming out of Finland are astonishing. That country's infant mortality rate dropped from 65 deaths per 1,000 in the 1930s to 3.5 per 1,000 in 1949. This is just a few years after the cardboard box idea was introduced in Finland. As you said, they're now, you know, number one in, you know, the least infant mortality deaths. Is it pretty clear to you it's the box?
Finland's current low point is the best in the world, and it should be celebrated. The universality of their program is probably a contributing factor, the fact that the families get this safe sleep education universally and are provided this safe sleep environment, I'm sure is impactful. But a lot has changed both in Finland and here in the United States since the 1930s, including infant vaccinations, prenatal care, that we also know have helped to impact infant mortality.
That's Dr. Catherine McCanns, pediatrician and chair of the New Jersey Child Fatality and Near Fatality Review Board. They are now giving away for free, if you watch the educational videos, these baby boxes. We'll have pictures at hereandnow.org. Dr. McCanns, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. And you know, a lot of people don't know that podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. At Here and Now, we want to change that. So all this month, we're inviting listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag tripod, that is hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks. AT&T, Verizon, and Johnson & Johnson are just the latest companies to take some of their ads off of Google and its video site YouTube. In a statement, AT&T said they are deeply concerned that their ads may have appeared alongside YouTube content promoting terrorism and hate. More than 200 companies have now taken down ads, including McDonald's, Volkswagen, and L'Oreal. Joining us with more is Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jeremy.
And this controversy really bubbled up in the UK last week. What happened?
The Times of London, a newspaper there, found that some of these videos on YouTube had advertisers associated with sort of brand names. And it's not that, you know, Mercedes decided that, you know, it really wanted to sell ads to jihadis. You know how this works, right? If you look up cars to buy and Mercedes and that kind of ad follows you around the internet, if you end up watching an extremist video after that, well, Google has stuff in place to try to stop that. Google, of course, owns YouTube. So they try to keep those ads from showing up there, but it's complicated. It's all kind of done by computer systems, and that's how they ended up there.
And after this all came up, they did make some changes at Google to try to stop this from happening. Will those work?
Well, it's too early to say. They say they're hiring hundreds more people. I mean, every minute, 400 hours of content gets uploaded to YouTube, and they don't have enough people to look at all of that. So they really rely on users to say this is inappropriate content, and they try to get stuff that is inappropriate down as quickly as possible. So they say they're hiring more people and that they're going to work on better technology.
How big of a deal is it for Google? What is this costing them to have these companies, big companies, pulling ads?
It's a big deal. No one will say exactly how much money is at stake here. it depends on how long this goes, too. So there are some analysts who say this could hurt Google's bottom line and show up, you know, with not as good of an earnings forecast. But it's really too early to tell.
And the other thing that's been brought up is that perhaps some of these companies that are pulling ads, like AT&T, like Verizon, have their own axes to grind with Google. They want to compete with Google. As we mentioned earlier, Verizon and Yahoo and AOL are kind of all part of one big media organization. Now, is that possible that this isn't about the extremist videos, but it's about their competition?
I think it's both. Yeah, I think certainly Verizon, AT&T, they have, you know, they have people looking at their phones and they want online video and online ad services the same way. They're going to have to deal with these same problems themselves when they do that. So there are also a lot of companies who said, you know, we really want more control, Google, over where our ads show up. And so they've always been asking for sort of more insight into this, more security, more protection. And so I think a lot of companies have sort of jumped on and used this as an opportunity to get what they've been asking for a while.
And are we expecting to see more changes from Google?
We'll see how these get received. Google is a company that sells advertising. This is very important to them. They have strong data science. They're going to work very hard on this, I imagine, to fix it. So if these changes aren't enough, I think we'll see more.
We've been saying Google. I've gotten so used to saying Google. I guess these days we should be saying Alphabet, the parent company. But
yeah, it affects
old habits die hard.
Too. Yeah, exactly.
Kurt Nick is senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Kurt, thank you.
My pleasure.
The first most of the world heard of Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton was in 2009 when he debuted a little something he was working on in a performance at the White House, backed on piano by his right-hand man.
Tonight, I'm accompanied by Tony and Grammy-winning music director Alex Lacamoire. And every day while slaves were being slaughtered or carted away across the waves, our Hamilton kept his guard up inside.
Alex Lacamoire had already won awards for his work on Manuel's In the Heights. Then Hamilton became a super hit. Alex was music director, orchestrator, music supervisor. So what did Alex Lacamoire do for an encore? Well, he paired with the other hot names in the musical world, Benj Pasek and Justin Paul, whose song City of Stars from La La Land just picked up an Oscar. Alex helped them create the hit Broadway show Dear Evan Hansen, which tells the story of Evan, a high school loner who becomes unexpectedly popular when he's mistaken for the friend of a deceased classmate and goes along with the fiction. Dear Evan Hansen has gotten raves. Words like gorgeous are used. The cast album, which Alex produced, is one of only seven cast albums to ever reach the top 20 of the Billboard 200 in the last 50 years. And Alex Lacamoire joins us now from KQED. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's so exciting what you do.
I feel lucky.
But what exactly do you do?
it depends what facet of my job we're talking about. As a music supervisor, my job is to basically manage everything music related in the show. Mm-hmm. In the case of Dear Evan Hansen, it was being there for rehearsals and helping to teach the cast the music, being the liaison between the director and the cast and the music director and the composer and the sound department. So kind of just globally overseeing the music. Mm-hmm. As the orchestrator, my job was to take the music that Pasek and Paul had written and figure out how to make it fit on a band. Decide when to use the strings, on what songs do I want to use the strings, and if they are playing strings, are they bowing, are they plucking, are they playing loud, are they playing soft?
All we see is sky for forever. We let the world pass by for forever. Feels like we could go on for forever this way. Two friends on a perfect day.
I was actually one of the producers for the cast album, and being in the studio to mix it, being in the studio to master it, all that stuff that goes into making the record a complete product.
So you do a lot, and so
I do a lot.
Let's just listen to on Dear Evan Hansen, one of the pieces that the main character Evan played by Ben Platt, sings. We understand when Justin Paul played Waving Through a Window, this song, on the piano in your apartment, you said, "I'm in." As we listen, what did you think?
I've learned to slam on the brake before I even turn the key, before I make the mistake, before I lead with the worst of me.
As soon as I heard the song, like, it just hooked me. It's so unbelievably melodic. It's so catchy, and it just sticks with you. There's such a longing to the music. There is such a yearning to it. It just aches in the most beautiful way.
On the outside, always looking in, will I ever be more than I've always been? 'Cause I'm tap, tap, tapping on the glass.
And what you did with this song and others on Evan Hansen is why Lin-Manuel and others involved with Hamilton and In the Heights say that you provide the DNA for their shows. For sure. Hamilton, for instance, what we heard your performance at the White House, just a very bare bass piano line. Were you already hearing in your head, here's what I want to do?
You know, it's very funny. At that moment, no. When we performed at the White House, I think I was just trying to figure out how to make a hip-hop song work with just a piano and, like, not have any drums.
And, I know, there's and the president.
Yeah, exactly. So at that moment, all I was thinking about is how to make the piano just be an orchestra, how to make it rock. But it wasn't until a while later, as we got through workshops, that Lynn suggested to me, hey, you know, I want the strings to be to Hamilton what the horns were to In the Heights. Hmm. And once he mentioned that, then I started to kind of get a palette in my mind about what this show was going to sound like. And from then on, I started to think in those terms.
The word got around, they said this kid is insane, man. Took up a collection just to send him to the mainland. Get your education, don't forget from whence you came. And the world's gonna know your name. What's your name, man? Alexander Hamilton.
Well, back to Dear Evan Hansen. I mean, do you pinch yourself? We'll listen to a little more of the music, but it's a hit again.
You will be found, so let the sun come streaming in, 'cause you'll reach up and you'll rise again. Lift your head and look around. You will be found.
I feel lucky that I work on the shows that move me, the shows that speak to me, musically speaking. And I just feel lucky that Hamilton did that for me, and that was also working with my friends. Mm. And with Dear Evan Hansen, the strength of the music, the strength of the story, the fact that it happened this way is pure coincidence.
Well, I'm sure you grokked, as they say, with the immigrant storyline of Hamilton. Hamilton being one. You eventually moved to Miami and grew up there, but your parents were born in Cuba. Dear mm-hmm. Evan Hansen is a lot about high school loneliness. Your dad suffered an aneurysm when you were four. He became disabled. And yet, as he recovered as much as he did, both your parents seemed to just dote on this prodigy that they had in their midst, this little kid who could play piano. How much did that upbringing shape who you are?
I feel it greatly did. You talked about Dear Evan Hansen and the loneliness of its character. That's something that I definitely experienced. I feel like I was very focused on my music. You know, I'm someone who would pore over album credits, who would pore over, you know, knowing who the individual members were of every band that I listened to and what went into making music happen. And not everybody has that same kind of obsession about it. So yeah. It was kind of hard to find people to relate on that level with because it really consumed me.
Guys like you and me, we're just the losers who keep waiting to be seen, right? I mean, no one seems to care or stops to notice that we're there, so we get lost in the in-between.
Well, there was something else going on, and let's explain. Yes, you were, you know, huddled way too close to the TV or the stereo, your parents started to notice. And it was soon discovered that you have a hearing loss, at least 15%. Yeah. You wear hearing aids. Was that slight deafness the thing that actually forced you to listen closer?
It's possible. Legend has it, when I was 2, I would stare at the stereo speaker, just transfixed by the sounds coming out of it. So I think there is something in there that always I was drawn to it. And perhaps my hearing, as you said, makes me listen to music a little bit more closely and makes me more fascinated by it, if you will. Maybe it's all just coincidence. Maybe that it all feeds one thing to the other. But I do believe all that kind of shapes who I am now, and all my, for the good and for the bad. It has definitely shaped me.
Well, I'm wondering if this is why you are drawn, at least for now, to Broadway, because of this big wall of sound that you can create.
Well, you know, what I think draws me the most to the theatrical experience, and we talked earlier about what that loneliness feels like. Theater is the opposite of that. Theater is community. Theater is family. And the fact that it's a group of all these separate people who have really excellent strengths at something that someone else might not have. And the fact that you rely on each other to create a production, like, okay, I can't get on stage until that light comes on, which means that the stage manager has to tell the light to come on, which means that the conductor needs to play that chord that means the lights are turning on, et cetera, et cetera. So it's all orchestrated, for lack of a better term. And I guess my OCD brain is very drawn to what that is and how all that happens.
Well, we're glad. That's Tony and Grammy-winning musician Alex Lacamoire, orchestrator, music supervisor, cast album producer for the Broadway musical Dear Evan Hansen. We'll link you to some pieces at hearnow.org. Also, Lin-Manuel Miranda's right-hand man, his musical DNA, as he's called him, for In the Heights and Hamilton, a trifecta. Alex, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's Here and Now.
President Trump's budget proposal may not get anywhere close to becoming law because some of his proposed cuts are opposed by members of his own party. Still, there is concern about the fate of spending on the arts, public broadcasting, the State Department, and the Denali Commission, which was established to help Alaska build infrastructure in rural areas. It costs about $8 million a year. Alaska's Democratic Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott is chair of the commission, co-chair. He joins us now. Lieutenant Governor, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And let's start with what exactly the Denali Commission does. Tell us more about it.
Well, the Denali Commission was created in the 1990s, and its purpose was to create a coordinating body that could both prioritize, expedite, and create the most efficient delivery of particularly infrastructure development in rural Alaska. You're aware that Alaska is really another country, 560-some thousand square miles. Rural Alaska has no road connections. It's really delivering projects and needed services to a third world area in many regards. And so the Denali Commission was created in order to allow federal state agencies to coordinate as effectively as possible to minimize the delivery costs of needed projects in rural Alaska.
So what are a couple of the projects that the Denali Commission is responsible for?
The Denali Commission in its history has been responsible for coordinating and arranging funding for hundreds of health clinics. It has funded transportation systems in those communities in rural Alaska that are along river corridors, for example. It has helped to fund major federal projects and state throughout rural Alaska during the time of its existence.
Now, back in 2013, the then Inspector General for the Commission, Mike Marsh, said it was a congressional experiment that hasn't worked out in practice. And he said money was being used for infrastructure projects like power plants and medical clinics in tiny towns that don't have the resources to keep them running. How do you respond to some of the criticism?
Well, certainly it has been a struggle to find resources and capacity in smaller communities to be as responsive as is possible, but they work. They have made a difference in the lives of Alaskans who, as is the case with every American in their communities, seek those services. If we are to judge the impact of federal spending in Alaska on a per capita basis, which is typically the way it is done, Alaska always suffers because we have a very small population, 750,000 people, the size of a moderate-sized city elsewhere in America, in a nation or in a country, in a state that is one-fifth the size of the entire United States. So if you measure impact of the spending of federal dollars or any dollars in Alaska on a per capita basis, we always come up short. And that's always been a difficulty for Alaska.
So were you surprised to see the Denali Commission cut in President Trump's budget?
I was surprised by President Trump's entire budget, speaking very frankly. And the Denali Commission is among a range of agencies that in my judgment, a very cursory and hurried development of the federal budget. And while I was surprised and believe that doing away with the Denali Commission will cost the federal government more in the delivery of needed services in rural Alaska over time, I believe that we will have the opportunity to make our case and look forward to doing so.
Do people in Alaska realize what's at stake here? Do your constituents?
The rural Alaska community certainly does. Our congressional delegation certainly does. The federal agencies and those of the state that work hard to achieve the kind of efficiency and productivity and cost-effective delivery of these projects and services fully do. And as I said, I believe we can make a very compelling case that the Denali Commission's work is indeed important.
That's Alaska's Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott, who is co-chair for the Denali Commission. Lieutenant Governor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.